You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. As we heard, hate crimes in California have increased just over the last year. The state is now home to 79 hate groups, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's more than anywhere in the country. When violence erupted in Charlottesville, many of us saw the images of young, clean-cut white men carrying torches, holding Nazi signs, and we wondered, who are they? A.C. Thompson is a reporter with ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. They're tracking hate crimes around the country, and he recently wrote about this new young crop of white supremacists. He came by our studios to talk about what hate groups are now in the forefront and who these young people are. So tell me about the Documenting Hate Project.
You know, shortly after the election occurred, folks at our company got together, and we were all sort of noticing a lot of reports of hate crimes, a lot of reports of racist violence, and a surge in sort of white supremacist activity. And the nerds I work with, the data people, they said what was fascinating to them was that the federal stats on this were garbage. And that's what drew them in. You know, they were horrified by these incidents, but they were also interested by the problem of why can't the government keep good data.
What part of the government is supposed to keep that data?
So the deal is the FBI goes out to all the police departments in the country, the sheriff's departments, all the local and state cops, and they say, hey, how many hate crimes did you have in your jurisdiction this year? And the problem is those local police and sheriffs don't have to actually give the FBI that information. They're supposed to, but they don't have to. And so a lot of them don't. So about 20% of the police departments don't give the FBI any data. So that takes out a fifth of the departments to start with. And then the rest that do, a lot of them just don't do a very good job. And so as a reporter, you'll look through the clips and you'll look through the news stories and you'll find, you know, this town had 20 different incidents over the last couple of years. But what you'll see is what they submitted to the FBI is that they had none.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it's a voluntary program, because a lot of departments don't want to participate, because a lot of police departments don't feel they need to actually give accurate information, it's a vast undercount that the FBI collects each year of hate violence and other hate crimes in the U.S. And we wanted to sort of see if we could add another layer of information to people.
And so you did what?
So what we did is we teamed up with about 100 news organizations around the country. And we said, hey, we're going to make a digital form. If your readers or listeners or viewers feel that they've been subjected to a hate crime or an incident of bigotry, they can report it. And we will share these as a collaborative, as a big team of 100 or so news organizations. We will follow up on them. We will see if these are accurate and true. We will see what happened, and we will see what the patterns are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we've been doing over the last year. We have more than 3,000 incidents in our data set. And what it really does is different than what the FBI does, because the FBI, their numbers, they're flawed, they're inaccurate, they're a low count. And they're just numbers. They say, this is what happened in California. We had X number of crimes against African Americans. We had X number of crimes against Latinos. We had X number of crimes against Jews, like that. What we have is we have all these people's personal narratives. We have the stories behind numbers. And those narratives tell you a lot about what's happening in the country right now.
Hmm. So tell me the value of these narratives. Can you give me an example of one or two?
There are three main themes that come out in these narratives. And one of them is that there's a crazy amount of anti-Semitism right now. And there are a crazy amount of reports of people having their synagogues defaced, of getting anti-Semitic flyers slipped under their door, of people that I've interviewed who had their cars tagged with swastikas, Jewish folks. And that's one thread that we see.
Mm-hmm.
Another thread that we see is intense anti-immigrant sentiment. And those type of words, get out of my country, leave, you don't belong here. That is another sort of pattern that we see, is this verbalized anti-immigrant sentiment. And the third main sort of narrative that comes out of these reports is a connection to Trump, a connection to the president of the United States of America. In many of these incidents, people will say, hey, Trump is going to deal with you people, get out of my country. Or they will spray paint a swastika and they will spray paint next to it, "Make America White Again." We get Trump references over and over and over again in these reports. And so when I hear people questioning, you know, is there a link between the current president of the United States and what seems to be an uptick in hate violence and bigotry, I say, yeah, there is. And I can see it in this data set, in these stories.
So you have reported recently on this new wave of white supremacists. So tell us who these people are. They're younger. You called them clean-cut frat boys. They don't look the look. We're used to a certain look, you know, the KKK with their white hoods, you know, someone with a swastika. They just looked like the boy next door.
Right.
Who are they?
When I was in Charlottesville, I kind of expected to see the sort of paleo racists, right? And the sort of last wave of white supremacists. And that would have been the skinheads, the Aryan Nations, the sort of racist survivalists, and the Klan. And most of those folks were really not present in a big way in Charlottesville. It was the new generation of white supremacists. And what I found interesting in talking to these young men, and overwhelmingly young, overwhelmingly men, many of them college educated, was that many of them had converted to this ideology in the last couple years or even the last couple months. The new breed used the term alt-right, which is not perfect, but covers part of it.
What do you think about that term?
The term alt-right is a rebranding of old white supremacist ideas. And these folks, they'll say, "I'm an alt-righter," or "I'm a white nationalist," or "I'm an identitarian." And really, all those terms mean, "I am a white supremacist. I believe that folks who are not white should get out of this country, and I want to exert my supremacy in that way." So to me, like, at the end of the day, you call these folks white supremacists.
And is this a resurgence, or did it just never go away, really?
In terms of organized, militant, political white supremacists, this is absolutely a resurgence. Absolutely. And this is the biggest boom in this movement that we've seen in decades. When Trump came into the picture, he was the first president in modern history to really give voice to the grievances of angry white people and say, "Hey, I'm going to blame this person and that person and that person and that person for the downfall of white folks." And that absolutely appealed to the new generation. And they said, "Hey, we're going to get on the Trump train. That will take us to the center of the political conversation, the news conversation right now. And we'll pull in more and more recruits who start by being interested in Trump." And they're white folks who are kind of angry and disgruntled. And we will convert them to our more radical ideology that goes far beyond Trumpism.
Which is not hard then to do? I mean, what is that conversion?
You know, what I've seen, right, is I see people that they have legitimate concerns, right? They are concerned about terrorism. That is a legitimate concern. You can absolutely have that. They're concerned about jobs. They're concerned that immigration can cause problems. And immigration is a complex sort of phenomenon. These are all legitimate concerns that people can have. And Trump spoke to them in forceful terms. What the white supremacists said is like, "Yeah, Trump, he is a step in the right direction, but we've got to go beyond that. You know, Jews are a problem." They say, like, "Look, Jews are this vast conspiracy who are controlling the world. You need to look at the Jews. The Jewish question is what they call it." They say, like, "It's not enough to just build a wall and kick people out of the country. We need to kick all the folks who aren't white out of this country." And there is a vast world of information and theory and blabbery about these kind of ideas online that's very easily accessible now.
And that should be the time where the sifting happens, where I look at myself and say, "Hey, am I still okay with being on this train or not?"
Right.
I either get off right now when this, you know, xenophobic talk starts, or I just keep on moving.
Right. And I think what I'm seeing is people are committing and diving deeper and deeper into the movement. Now, we'll see, because a lot of folks have been outed and been publicly exposed as racist and white supremacists in Charlottesville. People have lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. People have been harassed and so forth by anti-racists. And that may dissuade them from going down this path. Or it may just harden their resolve. You know, I don't think we know yet.
So the Southern Poverty Law Center released a map of hate groups. California has the highest number of hate groups. There's many categories: white nationalist, black separatist, anti-LGBT, anti-Muslim, and then there's a category called general hate. I don't understand what that means, but and there are quite a number right here in the Bay Area. Right. We opened this map the other day, just like San Francisco and Mountain View and Oakland. Mm. Should we be surprised that there are hate groups around us?
You know, I don't think so. And I think it's important to note that there are definitely a bunch of prominent figures in the new white supremacist movement who are from California, and Northern California in particular. So Nathan D'Amigo, who is, until recently, was the head of Identity Europa, one of the new big potent groups, is from out in Oakley.
Kind of Bay Area.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. At fringes of the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. When I flew from San Francisco to Charlottesville, I was on the plane with Johnny Monoxide, who is a Berkeley resident who was going to be one of the speakers at the rally, who's a white supremacist activist, a prominent figure in that scene. So I don't think, no, you shouldn't be surprised.
We like to think we're immune.
Exactly. And when we look in the Documenting Hate database, that was the thing. I pitched this as a story and nobody wanted to do it. But I said, look, there are all these incidents in the liberal bubble in the Bay Area. And to me, that's noteworthy. My boss has said, no, it's not. But I think it is.
Richmond, there was a mosque bomb in Tracy last year as well. It's just, it's here.
Oh, yeah.
It's here.
Absolutely. And lots of stuff that you're not seeing in the media. Lots of stuff. So, you know, I'm seeing reports of members of the Jewish faith being harassed in Berkeley. We've seen graffiti and racist graffiti at schools all over the Bay Area.
I know San Ramon, personally.
Yeah, right, mm-hmm. right. Alameda as well. And then, you know, we've had these incidents like what happened in Richmond with the attack on the Sikh gentleman, Mansingh Khalsa, the mosque bomb threat that mm-hmm. happened, was called in by a Trump supporter in Richmond as well. So, no, these things happen all over, mm-hmm. and they definitely are happening in California. I would say Southern California is more of a locus, though. I think there's more activity there, and I think there's a sort of harder core of Nazi skinheads and the new group of white supremacists down there.
Hmm. So what are you looking at right now? What's next? What are you writing about?
We're working on a story about police training and about how police departments around the country train new officers to deal with hate crimes. And what we're finding is, wow, that varies dramatically from
really?
Place to place. Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, first is because the laws totally vary, right? So every state has its own law. They cover different things. Many states don't cover sexual orientation or gender identity under their hate crimes law. So you can be charged for a hate crime for attacking an African American on the basis of their race, but you can't be charged for attacking a member of the LGBT community on the basis of their sexual identity, you know, that sort of thing. So the laws all vary. There's five states that don't even have the laws.
Wow.
Some of the states have laws that are nominally on the books, but they're just kind of a joke and they don't really work at all. And then all the different states have different approaches to training new police officers and sheriff's deputies. So some states will say, hey, they'll write it into their law, like, you got to train everyone that comes through the police academy. Give them 2 hours, explain to them what these laws do, what they need to do when they're investigating. But a lot of states don't do anything.
What about us?
California is good. Mm-hmm. California has, I would say, in general, for police training, is very sophisticated, very smart. The hate crimes training that we do in this state is very good, and it's mandated by law. And in terms of documenting reports of hate crimes in California, California is like one of the only states, I would say, if you're looking at statistics here, they're probably basically accurate.
Mm-hmm. But the number is still getting higher?
2015, there was an increase nationally and in California. The early reports that we're getting on 2016 and 2017 data are suggesting there's going to be a nationwide increase as well.
Hmm. Do you see this getting better or worse?
What concerns me is that the organized white supremacists, I believe, are the pointy tip of the spear of a much broader trend in this society. I think they will probably never be mass numbers. They will probably never wield a lot of political power, but I think their ideas are mainstreaming all the time, and they are becoming more widely disseminated and more widely appreciated. And I think an example of that that you see is when you look at the memo that was written by the Google engineer, James Damore, about gender equality in the tech industry. That resonated with a lot of people, with a lot of people. The first place he goes to discuss that was on a far-right YouTube channel. And I think in the same way with the race issues, with religious issues, with immigration issues, all the sort of core issues for the white supremacists, there is a lot of appreciation for those ideas, increasing appreciation by a lot of average, what I would call casual racists.
What's a casual racist?
A casual racist is someone who is a hater and they're gonna be hateful online and they might talk trash to their neighbor, but they're not going to join an organized white supremacist group.
So there's more of those? Is gonna be more of those?
I think there's more of them day by day. And I think that the ideas that get promulgated by the hardcore, by the organized racists, are seeping into the center of society and helping to convert more and more people to a sort of racist understanding of the world. Maybe they start off and they're somewhat racist, and then they start hearing all these ideas. The Jewish conspiracy, Muslims are trying to impose Sharia law all over the world, and they get more and more hooked on that. And maybe they never join a movement, but it sort of will reflect in how they conduct their business day to day.
All right. I think that's all I can take.
I'm sorry to be such a downer. I apologize.
I mean, how do you find the energy to do this work? And is it depressing? Is it hard? It needs to be done. It's necessary. But do you feel sometimes that it's just too much?
After Charlottesville, every day for 2 weeks, I had nightmares because it was such a dystopian scene. You know, you had armed militias in the streets. You had the police checking out and letting people just beat each other senseless. And then you had this whole cavalcade of new white supremacists with clubs and guns and knives and their banners, their Nazi banners and their shields and helmets. And I just thought, this is like an absolutely dystopian scene. And it just haunted me for days. And sometimes I feel like that. I wake up and I think, oh, I didn't sleep well last night. All of this is getting to me.
But it's the work you must do.
This is what I have to do. This is, you know, crucial to do. And I'm lucky because we have this community of reporters, you know, from all across the country that are doing this together.
In a time when you're being attacked as a journalist, too.
That's another thing that's worth understanding is like the street demonstrations, they can be scary, they can be disheartening, they can be absolutely disturbing. But what's really happening day to day is a sort of information warfare, right? So folks in the new white supremacist movement are incredibly good at using technology and using social media to identify their opponents and expose them to harassment, ridicule, and abuse. And on the other side, the militant anti-fascists are doing the same thing. So I think really the thing for us as journalists is that we get caught in the middle of that. And so, you know, folks that I work with have been doxxed and harassed. Their mothers have gotten harassing, threatening phone calls. ProPublica's email got shut down 2 days in a row by white supremacist hackers. And really what's going on now is an information war that threatens to keep people from feeling like they can freely express themselves online or in the public square.
And that is supported by the highest levels of government.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that you have a chief executive who has given sort of free rein to that abuse on journalists.
All right, A.C. Thompson, thank you.
I'll say something more cheery next time.